Okay, today is April 16th, 2016. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, so we've been discussing the sutta number 148 in the Majjhimanikaya. This is called in Pali the Chakka Sutta, which means the six sets of six. And the theme of this discourse is the teaching of non-self anatta. And the way the Buddha, in this sutta, the way he approaches the teaching of non-self is by going through the six groups of factors involved in six stages in the process of sense perception leading up to craving. So we have six internal sense bases, or the six sense faculties. There are six objects, six types of consciousness, six types of contact, six types of feeling. And based on the six types of feeling, six types of craving. So each is oriented to a particular sensory domain. Okay, then the Buddha, in the first part of the discourse, he develops what I call a demonstration of non-self. No, we need the light. No. Is that all?
I think she meant the light need warm up.
Okay, so he develops what I call a demonstration of non-self. That is, it seems to be using logical reasoning in order to show or to prove or to expose the truth of non-self. And it's done as though he's working through a process of logical reasoning, even though the point of this is not logic, but it's a kind of exercise in contemplation, or let's say a kind of reflective investigation or examination to see why each of these bases or objects is in fact non-self. And so what's underlying the notion of self here, this is from sort of reviewing what I covered last time, what underlies the notion of self is the notion of permanence or stability or persistence. So when the Buddha uses the word self in this philosophical context, he's using it, sharing with the Indian systems of thought of that period, the idea that the concept of self, the very idea of self, implies something which persists, which lasts, which endures. And in most Indian systems, the idea of self is connected with eternal existence. that which exists permanently. In other contexts, when the Buddha uses the word self, this is what I call the ethical or the spiritual context, then he uses the word self in a positive way or an affirmative way, that he speaks about the need to purify oneself, to take responsibility for oneself, to transform oneself, to liberate oneself. And it's using the same Pali word, or in Sanskrit, the same Sanskrit word, atta or atman. But that's just a kind of concession to the ordinary, call it the everyday or conventional use of the word self. But when the Buddha's shifting over to the philosophical context, where the idea of self, or psychological context, where the idea of self is that which we cling to with the notion, this is what I really am, this is my true identity, then the Buddha tries to demonstrate the invalidity of that notion, or the non-ultimacy of that notion, that this philosophical idea of self does not correspond to anything in reality. When somebody tries to fill in the idea of self, we have this idea sort of arising in the mind, I am, or I have a self. And then one tries to figure out, what is myself? What is the self? Then one does so by taking one or another of the five aggregates and saying, this is myself. Or in this sutta, the Buddha doesn't use the five aggregate scheme, but he uses the scheme of the six sense bases, their objects, states of consciousness, and so on. So if there's to be a self, it has to exist in relation to the six sense bases, six types of consciousness, and so on. But now, this is where sort of the Buddha homes in on the problem. The idea of self is connected to the idea of permanence or persistence. And so if we identify anything as self, that thing identified as self has to be permanent, lasting, persistent. But when one identifies anything with self, what one identifies is the six sense bases, six types of consciousness, anything in the six types, six groups of six. And when we look into any of those things identified as self, we see that it is subject to arising and passing away, coming into existence, going out of existence. Okay, so here we just take paragraph 10 as sort of a paradigm for this type of argument. So if somebody says that the I is self, that isn't valid, not acceptable. The reason it's not acceptable is because the rise and fall of the I are discerned. The I is seen arising and passing away. Okay, and so if somebody says that the I is self, then it would follow that myself arises and passes away. And therefore it follows that it's not acceptable to say the I is self. Okay, then the same applies to everything else in these six groups of six. I think that's as far as I got last time, is that correct? It's a rhetorical question. Okay, does anybody have any questions on this before we go further? And questions directly relevant to the topic? Okay, you speak loudly, Robbie.
Aren't the internal bases part of the Panchakanda, which is a...
Yeah, it's just that the Buddha isn't using the Panchakanda in the sutta at this point.
Yeah, but most of us, when we refer to ourselves, we refer to the body and everything else.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Part of Panchakanda, not completely in the sense bases as such. Sense bases are limited.
Yeah, but this sutta is using the sense bases as the theme.
Thank you.
Okay, so shall we continue on to the next part of the sutta? Okay, so now we come to a section which is titled The Origination of Identity. Okay, and this begins, now, bhikkhus, this is the way leading to the origination of identity. And this is a difficult word to translate into English. I mean, the Pali word is difficult. Identity is not really satisfactory. But let's see what the Pali word is. Yeah, the Pali word is sakkaya, which is a compound of the word sat, which means existing, real, present, plus kaya, which normally means body. Now, I notice the Chinese translators sometimes often use shen for sakkaya, which is somewhat misleading, because then it gives the impression that it's just the physical body that's intended. But sakkaya is the combination of the five aggregates. So the word kaya here doesn't have the narrow denotation of the physical body. But kaya is used in the sense of a collection. And so this is the collection of things that are actually existing that make up one's, or the collection of the things that constitute one's actual existence. And what are these things that make up sakkaya, personal identity? These are the five aggregates. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain here the origination of identity. And he does this, again, he's using here the sense bases as the sort of theme of exposition. So he says, one regards the I thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. One regards forms, I consciousness, eye contact, feeling, craving thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Okay, within the statement about regarding things, the way one regards things, we have three terms And the commentary connects these three terms with three different mental afflictions or defilements. Okay, so mind, the idea of this is mine, that is a kind of expression of which mental defilement? What do you think? I think Sandy got it. Say it loudly. Right. So the reason... one takes things to be mine is because of craving. So I see in a shop a pair of very stylish polarized sunglasses and I think I want to be stylish. And so I want to make them mine. And so then I buy them and I can wear them and be very stylish. Okay, so this is a kind of reflection of craving. Then this I am is a reflection of which defilement? Exactly, right. This is mana, the conceit. Particularly the conceit I am. And so one thinks... usually the texts speak about three modes of conceit. So that when we hear the word conceit, we always think that to have conceit means that you imagine yourself to be better than others. But according to the Buddhist text, there are actually three modes of conceit. So the grossest is the conceit I am bitter, taking oneself to be, you know, superior to others. But then there's also the conceit, it's called sadiso hamasmi, the conceit I am just as good as they are. You know, when you're feeling down as a little kid, little boy or little girl, your mother says, you're just as good as they are. Okay, so then you feel that confidence, I'm just as good as they are. So that's the conceit. We call this the similarity conceit. And then the third type of conceit is the conceit, I am inferior. So everybody looks so beautiful, but I am so ugly. Everybody's so smart, oh, I'm so stupid. Everybody else is such a great meditator, but I always have these distracting and disturbing thoughts. Everybody else has so healthy, I have all of these health problems, I'm weighed down by my karma, So all of this sort of depressed, melancholy way of thinking about oneself is also an expression of conceit. Okay, then the third idea that arises here, this is myself, is an expression or manifestation of what particular mental affliction? This is a little tricky. Okay, this is a reflection of views. And so, actually, it seems to me that there's a very close similarity between this I am and this is myself. So the question might come up, like, what is the difference between them? And they do, as I said, they seem very similar. But the way I try to describe the difference between them, I would say that the notion, this I am, sort of centers around the idea of I am. So this is a more spontaneous idea, less philosophical idea, less reflective idea. So it's just the idea I am arises, and then one starts rating oneself by comparing oneself with others and then rating oneself where one stands on the spectrum of superiority, inferiority in relation to others. But the idea that this is myself, this is where one takes the idea of self and starts filling in the content. Am I my body? Is that myself? Is the mind the self? Is the self something distinct from body and mind? Some kind of eternal spirit hiding in the background or way up above, manifesting through the body and mind? So all of these speculative ideas that revolve around the self, these all come under the category of views. And now the Buddha, or the text, describes this as the origination of Sakkaya, the origination of personal identity. And this could be understood, actually, in two ways. One, I would say, is the way which is directly visible here and now, in that it's through grasping upon any of these objects, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and so forth, that one creates a sense of one's personal identity right here and now. So one's sense of identity is constructed by grasping upon things as mine, building upon them the idea I am, and then by fashioning and constructing views about the relation of oneself to these things that one is grasping. So this is looking at the origination of personal identity from what I would call a direct, immediately visible, this life perspective. But there's another perspective to this, which is the relationship between these ideas of mine, I, and myself and the construction of personal identity from one life into future lives. And so from this perspective, it's the grasping of things as mine, I, and myself that functions as the cause for bringing into being a collection or an assemblage of the five aggregates in the following life. So because in this life I am grasping, let's use the five aggregates, that's easier than the six. Okay. I don't have to go through 36 items. Okay, because I'm grasping bodily form, feeling, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness, and thinking this is mine, this I am, this is myself, so that grasping is attached to these five aggregates, here and now, and the stream of consciousness is carrying along that grasping. And so as long as the stream of consciousness is flowing along based on this physical body, then I'm constantly grasping one or another of the five aggregates with the idea, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Okay, now the body falls away at death, can no longer support the stream of consciousness. But within that stream of consciousness, there is still that tendency to grasp at mine, to grasp after something as I am, to grasp after something as myself. But the life has come to an end. And so what happens? Okay, this is Johnny while alive. He's constantly grasping at the five aggregates as mine, I, myself. Shouldn't have used the word. Okay, this is Jimmy. Well, Lenny, we'll call it Lenny. Okay, this is... Lenny in his coffin. Okay. Body can't support anything. It can't support the stream of consciousness anymore. But when he dies, there's still that grasping. So what happens? That grasping after mind, I, and self brings into being a new set of the five aggregates, which come into being on the occasion of conception in the new life, and then as the embryo evolves and develops and comes out at the occasion of birth, then it becomes the new person, the new being. And so then this new being will inherit no longer Lenny. Let's say he's reborn in India, so we'll give him the name Rajiv. Okay, but the stream of consciousness passes over from Lenny into Rajiv. The karmic tendencies are still there, the character dispositions, and that grasping of mind, I, and self. And so that will continue now based upon a new physical organism, a new set of the five aggregates. Okay, so that is the origination of identity. And here the sutta just develops it for all of the six sixes. So we don't have to go into the full exposition. Just when you see how it works for one, then it works in the same way for all. Okay, now we come to what's called the cessation of identity, the cessation of personal identity. And here the text says, one regards the I thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And this is the way one contemplates the six sense bases or the five aggregates when doing the vipassana or insight meditation. So first, usually in the process of developing insight, one begins with the characteristic which is most apparent, the characteristic of impermanence arising and passing away. Then whatever arises and passes away, one sees to be inherently insecure, unreliable, and therefore bound up with suffering, so it's dukkha. And then whatever is impermanent and bound up with dukkha is not to be taken as oneself, as non-self. And so then one moves into contemplating the six sense bases or the five aggregates. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So this is the theme of contemplation in vipassana or insight meditation. And even though we are contemplating not mine, not I, not myself, as long as we are still ordinary people or worldlings, putujanas, we don't really know this to be truth. You know, we just accept it on trust from the Buddha, from the text, and we use it as our module or template for contemplation. But when there takes place the breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma, that is what occurs with the attainment of stream entry, then one sees directly, clearly, indubitably the truth of non-self. That the very idea of self is seen to be a delusion or a fabrication. And so that idea of self falls away. And so the stream enterer and those at the higher stages can see directly and with knowledge, not just with trust or confidence, but they see with knowledge this, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, but for the stream enterer, even for the stream enterer, even for the once returner, even for the non-returner, though they've seen this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. They've gotten rid of the idea of self, but there's still a subtle grasping to the idea of mine and the idea I am. I think it was last class I referred to this sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Kemaka Sutta, where the monk Kemaka is explaining how this is the Indian method, the old traditional Indian method of washing clothes. They take the clothes, which are dirty and grimy and sweaty, and then they put it in a bucket of water with, they use cow dung or, anybody know what they use in Egypt? Lye? Would lye damage the clothes? Oh, I think it might be lime. Lime, you know, not the fruit.
Well, lye is an ingredient in making soap.
Oh.
Yeah,
so maybe they use lye also. Okay, let's just say the cow dung is what they use. Okay. Yeah, no, they use it. That's what they use. So they use it in order to get rid of all of the dirt, sweat, grime, stains, and so on. And then you clear out the water, and the clothes are now clean, but they still have the odor of the cow dung. It's a pleasant odor. Because it's just digested grass, that's all. But then what they do is to take the clothes and put them in a casket with ground up sandalwood powder or jasmine, you know, flowers or other types of nice fragrances. And then after some time, then they take the clothes out from the casket, and the clothes have a very nice smell. And so at the stage of the stream entera, this is like clearing out the dirt and grime of the clothes with the cow dung. So he's gotten rid of the idea of self and accepting the reality of mine and I. But still some kind of odor of I and mine, a subtle tendency to I and mine still remains within his mind. Okay, but then he develops the insight further until he reaches the fourth and final stage of realization. This is the stage of arahatship. And at that point, all grasping after mine and I are purged completely. Okay, so when we speak about the cessation of identity, again, we could look at it from the similar two perspectives. First, from the immediately visible this life perspective, that by contemplating this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, one is deconstructing one's sense of personal identity. So one is looking at one's five aggregates, but one is removing from them that, you know, that grasping to them as mine and I, which manifests in many ways as, you know, pride, jealousy, envy, self-importance, ambition. Okay, so just by contemplating, even with insight, or even just by reflection, this is not mine, this is I am not, this is not myself, it helps to remove those, we call these the negative subjective tendencies. And it's very useful even to do this as a reflection. Now, to give an example from my own experience, you know, going way back many years ago when I had to give my first Dhamma talks, you know, I was very, very frightened. You know, that I'm going to make mistakes, everybody will be looking at me very critically, laughing at me, asking me difficult questions that I can't answer, but just the worst fear, just sitting there, maybe drawing little pictures in your books. And the Buddha made the most astounding discovery. So what do I do if they're all sound asleep? Okay, then I use this reflection, not mine, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And it was very helpful. So when everybody fell asleep, I didn't take it personally. And when somebody asked me a difficult question, I didn't get too angry with them. Okay, so this, I lost track. Okay, so this is the useful contemplation in deconstructing the sense of identity that you could use. You know, you don't have to be a great meditator with high stages of insight, but even if you just do this as a reflection, when you're doing your regular meditation, just go through the five aggregates, reflecting for bodily form, not mine, not I, not myself. Feeling, not mine, not I, not myself. Perception, volitional activities, consciousness, each one, not mine, not I, not myself. Here there is nothing that's mine, nothing, no real I, nothing to be taken as myself. And then you'll see that it, over time, not just at one session, not just one or two sessions, over time, it helps to improve patience, humility, kindness towards others, consideration of others. And it's moving in the direction, it sort of trains the mind in the direction of wisdom. Okay, then, when there takes place the breakthrough to the attainment of the lower stages of realization, then one is in the process of deconstructing the sense of identity. And then with the realization of arhatship, then the sense of identity is completely eliminated. And so the arhat in this life has no idea, or let's say no grasping after the ideas of mine, I, or self. So that is the deconstruction of personal identity that's possible in this life itself, to be realized in this life itself. And then, looking at it from the multi-life perspective, the realization of not mine, not I, not myself brings an end to this process, repeated process. Yeah, this time he's been reborn as a dog, yeah. Okay, he can't do that contemplation as a dog. Let's give him the next human life. Okay, so he has a lot of merits. And so now he contemplates not mine, not I, not myself. He reaches arhatship, then passing away. No more rebirth, nibbana. What?
Thank you.
Okay, at this point now I'll ask whether there's any questions. Okay. Wait, please take the microphone.
What happens to the stream of consciousness when an arhat reaches
the mind? Oh, I didn't want to get into that topic. I'll punt on that question for now, because I think I've dealt with it in previous classes, and it's pretty difficult to answer. Okay. Let us say, I'll put it very simply. The way I understand it, the stream of consciousness becomes nibbanized. That is, it goes outside its the sphere of space-time causation, and it becomes unconditioned. It's not that consciousness becomes unconditioned, but consciousness gives way, because consciousness is always conditioned, arising and passing away. But the stream of consciousness, you could say, gives way to the unconditioned, the ultimate element, nibbana.
Thank you.
Okay, Barbara?
I find that this I me self, I me mine,
yeah,
that persists from Jimmy to Robbie,
yeah,
is the one place in the Dhamma where I have to just take it on faith. I don't see any, I can't see any evidence,
yeah,
that occurs.
I see. You mean that?
So how did the Buddha come up with it? How is it that we have it? And can it be explained so that I can get a sense of...
I'm not quite sure that you don't...
I can't believe,
yeah,
yet that persists into a new life.
You mean that the stream of consciousness moves,
yes,
on to a new life?
Yes.
Okay, I think I've dealt with this before also. As far as hard, concrete evidence goes... You know, unless one has the ability to recollect previous lives, and I make no claim to have that ability myself, there's no direct evidence. The Buddhist texts, of course, in the Buddhist texts, the Buddha again and again speaks about rebirth. He speaks about that he himself recollects his previous lives, that he sees other beings arising and passing away. And then he says that others can develop this ability. It's not like it's a special knowledge unique to himself. To gain that knowledge depends on first mastering the four jhanas, which make the mind very, very tranquil, and then using that powerful, concentrated mind to go back in time until it brings up recollections of previous lives. Of course, one could say, okay, the mind is capable of almost anything. So you could say that, okay, you get what you think are recollections of previous lives. These are just, you know, very subtle fantasies that the mind is creating, just like in a dream. Now, I don't know how to refute a claim like that. But let me just say that there's been research done by a few very courageous scientists who have had to go against the whole materialistic, physical reductionistic orientation of the physical sciences. And they've done research in cases where there are like children especially in Buddhist and Hindu countries where the idea of rebirth is accepted, but also children, even in countries, Islamic countries, who claim that when they're able to speak, that apart from the parents, their actual biological parents, that they have another set of parents, and they'll describe the situation in which they were living, what their parents looked like, what their house looked like. And these scientists, particularly one was E.N. Stephenson, who was at the University of Virginia Medical School. His famous book was called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. You know, one can say, you know, this is absolutely convincing proof that rebirth is real, but what he's done is to take all of the facts and line them up and offer different ways to explain this phenomena. And then he says, out of the different explanations, the simplest is that, in this case, consciousness is actually passed from the deceased into a new life. And he's not doing this because he's a convinced... whether he was a Buddhist himself, that I don't know. But he didn't come with like a predisposition to the idea of rebirth, but it was just a topic that interested him, and he investigated it. And there's somebody else continuing his investigation, his type of investigation. I don't remember the name of that other scientist. Somebody else? Is it Rob?
Yeah, Bhante. It's a really question that she asked. As a child, I remember reading stories not in Asia, but also in the West. There was two children had died in a car crash or something, yeah. And they had found that, they said that in the previous life, twins were born, and they said that in the previous life, they died together in a crash when they were crossing the street. So this is about children born in Asia. And recently I read about a story about a young boy was drawing very violent paintings, and they retributed me.
I'm not catching your words.
Yeah, a young boy who was drawing very violent drawings, paintings, and he had said that he died when the ship or whatever in Japan, when they were just attacked, no problem with the Japanese, and he died. He was an officer in that ship. A couple of years ago, I read the...
Was it a ship or an airplane?
American boy, a young boy.
Was it a ship or an airplane?
Huh?
A ship or an airplane?
Maybe airplane, whatever.
I think I remember something like that. A boy, he was able to draw the plane.
Yeah, right.
And...
he just brought down, whatever he did, brought down and he died.
Yeah, I think it was on... there was a YouTube video of it. A boy who was able, I think he was killed in a plane fight, maybe it was in World War II.
Right.
And then he was able to draw the plane in which he was shot down.
And subsequently, they investigated and they found that. But there's another little question that I had, just a clarification. Sakkaya Ditti is a Sanyojana. From that the five, we call it, not attachment, the ten
fetters.
Fetters, yeah. That one, of course, is with the first stage of enlightenment, first stage stream entry, yeah. The one you said that we attain Avanchit, is that the eighth stage? Eighth level, that is the Manas? Is that the one? You said once you are enlightened, then you have gotten up completely.
Yeah.
The concept of Sakkaya Ditti.
Yeah.
That is at the, what they refer to as Manas in the Sanyojana? The eighth one.
Oh, I see. No, that's Mano. That is conceit.
Yeah. So is that the one that you said that at that point they are enlightened? And then, so the enlightenment, they won't be having that at all.
But I think the point I was making is that only the arhat is completely eliminated, the conceit I am. Even the stream enterer, once returner, non returner, still have that conceit I am.
Right. But this is that manas, that at that level, once you attain enlightenment, that's gone also.
Yeah.
So is that the same thing you're referring to?
As far as the conceit I am, that's what I'm referring to.
Thank you.
But the stream enterer has eliminated the view of self, but not the idea I am.
I have a question. I have your chart compared further and you say in front of me that restlessness, the ninth feather, is not in Anusaya. Can you elaborate why it's not an underlying tendency?
I don't recall coming across any explanation. It was just saying that the anusayas play a more major role as defilements, whereas restlessness is just a kind of disturbance of the mind. That's all I could guess. Okay, I want to move on now to the last part of the sutta. Okay, so now we come to a section called the underlying tendencies. These are, in Pali, the anusaya. Okay, so the word anusaya, it comes from the verbal, from the stem saya, which means lying, or like lying down, and anu, which means along with. So these are things that lie or sleep along with the flow of the mind. And often the Buddha speaks, Johnny referred to just before, about seven anusayas. We see them mentioned in sutta number 18. The seven anusaya. This would be on page 202. In section number 8, you speak about the underlying tendency to lust, this is sensual lust, the underlying tendency to aversion or ill will, to views, to doubt, to conceit, to the craving for existence, and the underlying tendency to ignorance. Okay, but in this sutta, or this sutta will speak about only three anusayas, three underlying tendencies or latent tendencies, because this sutta is going to develop or is going to explain the relationship between the underlying tendencies and feelings. And probably this is most relevant because the first part of the sutta developed the scheme of the six sixes, and the fifth of the sixes are the six types of feelings. And the six types of feelings can be divided or any kind of feeling can be divided into three types, looking at it from a different angle. So, let's say we have six types of feelings here. By way of sense, domain, and then each of these can be divided in terms of its quality into three, as either pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. Okay, so the sutta, this particular sutta, begins, as usual, taking the eye, the organ of vision, as the starting point. So he says that dependent upon the eye and forms, consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact, there arises a feeling that is felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. Okay, at this point, it's very similar to the first part of the sutta. Okay, but now it's going to tackle the relationship between the feeling and the underlying tendencies. So it's so the text says, when one is touched by a pleasant feeling, if one delights in it, welcomes it, and remains holding to it, then the underlying tendency to lust, this is the raga anusaya, the latent tendency to lust, lies within one. Or I would say, it's a strange idiom in Pali, I would say in that case it's the latent tendency to lust which has now become activated. You know, it's always lying in the dormant state, but it's when the pleasant feeling impinges on the sense, and then one turns to that pleasant feeling, or one turns to the object that arouses the pleasant feeling, and one grasps after the pleasant object because of the pleasant feeling, that occurrence is activating, stimulating, or provoking the underlying tendency to lust. So now that underlying, because of the impact of the pleasant object, the underlying tendency to lust, which had been sleeping, it's now woken up and becomes active. Okay, then, in the second case, when one is touched by a painful feeling, if one sorrows, grieves and laments, weeps, beating one's breast. Do people in America do that? When they're grief-stricken? It seems to be common in Asia, at least in Sri Lanka, when somebody loses a loved person. A loved one, oh, my misery. And so one weeps, beating one's breast, and becomes distraught, confused, bewildered, then the underlying tendency to aversion lies within one. Okay, so in this case, there's some painful contact takes place, giving rise to a painful feeling. And then in response to that painful feeling, then that tendency to aversion is woken up and becomes activated. And so then one reacts to the pain, to the source of the painful feeling, either trying to escape from it, to flee from it, to oppose it and destroy it. And so in this case, aversion is activated, which takes the fear, could take the form of anger, hatred, fear, resentment, annoyance, irritation. All of those are manifestations of this tendency to aversion. Okay, then when one is touched by a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, kind of feeling we call neutral, if one does not understand, as it actually is, the origination, the passing away, the gratification or enjoyment, the danger or the drawbacks, and the escape in regard to that feeling, then the underlying tendency to ignorance lies within one. Or I would say the underlying tendency to ignorance has become activated. And so, in the case of neutral feeling, in order to overcome the ignorance, one has to see that that neutral feeling is subject to arising, passing away. One has to know what is the enjoyment in that feeling, the pleasant feeling that arises, or the pleasure that lies within that neutral feeling, the drawback in it, or the danger, and then the escape or release from it. But if one doesn't understand that, then the underlying tendency to ignorance has become activated. Okay, then the Buddha makes a very powerful statement. He says that one shall here and now... Let me change the syntax a little bit. With that, without abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, without abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, without extirpating or uprooting the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, without abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, that one shall here and now make an end of suffering or dukkha, that is impossible. Okay, then the same is developed through the other sense domains. And then we come to the abandoning of the underlying tendencies. Okay, we start off in the same way, up to feeling. Okay, when one is touched by a pleasant feeling, if one does not delight in it, welcome it, and remain holding to it, then the underlying tendency to lust does not lie within one. So it seems to me the way I would sort of reformulate this to myself. Okay, when one is touched by a pleasant feeling, in order to eliminate the underlying tendency to lust, one should not delight in it, welcome it, and remain holding to it. You know, when one delights in the pleasant feeling, then it's reinforcing, strengthening the tendency to lust. But when one is touched by pleasant feeling, if one doesn't delight in it, but restrains the mind so that one experiences the pleasant feeling, but not delighting in it and grasping it, then one is weakening that underlying tendency to lust. And then when one gains insight into the nature of the pleasant feeling, then one eliminates the underlying tendency to lust. Okay, when one is touched by the painful feeling, if one does not sorrow, grieve and lament, does not weep, and so on, then the underlying tendency to aversion does not lie within one. Again, I would sort of change the word order a little bit or reformulate this to make it more practical. So I would say, when one is touched by painful feeling, in order to weaken the underlying tendency to aversion, one should not sorrow, grieve, and lament, weep, and become distraught. You know, the painful feeling will arise, and then the tendency will come up to push away from the painful feeling and become upset and miserable. But if one doesn't become upset and miserable when the painful feeling occurs, but one is able to observe it with equanimity, then one is gradually weakening the tendency to aversion. And then when the insight into the nature of the painful feeling becomes sharp and clear, then one eliminates the underlying tendency to aversion. Is that clear, or is it too abstract? Okay, when one is touched by the neither painful nor pleasant feeling, if one understands its origin, its passing away, and so forth, then the underlying tendency to ignorance does not lie within one. Again, I would sort of reformulate it in a more practical way. When one is touched by the neither painful nor pleasant feeling, one should understand its origin, passing away, gratification, danger, and escape. And in that way, one will be weakening the underlying tendency to ignorance. And when one gains a very clear insight into these things, then one will eradicate the underlying tendency to ignorance. Okay, then the Buddha sort of sums up. He says, again, I'll just change the syntax a bit. Okay. That by abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, by abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, by uprooting the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to the neutral feeling, by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, that one shall here and now make an end to suffering. This is possible. Okay, and then the same thing is unfolded according to the other five senses. We might as well just wrap up the sutta. Okay, then what comes at the very end is just the usual sequence that we encounter again and again. Okay, seeing thus, the well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, consciousness, eye contact, feeling, craving, becoming disenchanted. I'm jumping over the other senses. He becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated, and he understands birth is finished. That is, the cycle of repeated births is finished. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. Okay, then the very last statement of this sutta is not the usual ending with monks, the light, and the Buddha's saying, and that's it. But there's an additional sentence here which maybe underscores the importance of the discourse. Okay, so this is what the Buddha said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. Now, while this discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, the minds of 60 bhikkhus were liberated from the taints. Okay, that is the end of the sutta, but then there's a note here referring to the commentary. You see, there's a tendency in Buddhist literature for numbers to keep on increasing and increasing and increasing. So the early stage, you know, let's say the minds of 60 monks were liberated, and an early person in the early period hearing that would think, wow, 60 monks achieved arhatship. That's fantastic. But a few centuries later, they would be thinking, 60 monks achieved arhatship. That's like saying that some real estate developer has constructed a 10-story building, a skyscraper. You know, 20th century, 21st century, we hear somebody has built a 10-story building. What? Nothing to be excited about. You know, so a few centuries later, 60 monks, not enough. You know, we have to have 60,000. You know, by the time you get to the the Mahayana Sutras, it's 60 billion monks achieved arhatship. 60 nayutas, 60 kotis of nayutas. Okay, so the commentary says, okay, there is nothing wonderful in the fact that 60 monks achieved arhatship when the Buddha first taught the sutta. But each time Sariputta, Moggallana, and the 80 great disciples taught it, 60 monks attained arhatship. In Sri Lanka, the elder Malayadeva taught the sutta in 60 places, and each time 60 monks attained arhatship. And when the elder Tripitaka master Chula Naga taught the sutta to a vast assembly of humans and gods, at the end of the discourse, 1,000 bhikkhus attained arhatship, and among the gods, only one remained a worldling. So it seems a bit like, you know, the Buddha teaches it, and 60 achieve arhatship. How could he claim to be the Buddha when his disciples are surpassing him? Okay, so if there are any questions and matters that refer that could be cleared up quickly, then we'll take those questions now. Otherwise, we'll come back for discussion after the meal.
Bhante, at the end it says they're liberated from the taints. Yeah. That's asava.
That's the asava.
So that's separate from the anusaya. Anusaya.
Because in the suttas, the attainment of liberation is always expressed as being liberated from the asavas. Always. It's never stated that way in terms of the anusayas. Okay, I don't see any hands raised, so we'll just end with the sharing of the merits. You know, another cause of my trepidation back in those early days when giving first Dhamma talks. Are there any questions? Nobody raises the hand. Then I think Probably nobody was paying attention. Was everybody paying attention? Okay. So maybe I'll ask some questions when we come back. Okay, so let us do the shape. Oh! Okay, yeah, you printed this out here. Okay, because I brought the ones that we prepared last week. I brought them back to my room, saying I'll bring them next week.
It's bigger font and it's glossy.
Excuse me?
It's bigger font, the new printout. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll do the sharing of the mirrors. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanomoditva shiram rakantu sasanam Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanomoditva shiram rakantu desanam Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanomoditva shiram rakantu mam param Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya avici hetato etantare satakayu papanna rupia rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, we end three and a half hours for the Buddha.
Out of context.